Call, the copyrighted program created by the Rio Grande Oil Company.
Los Angeles Police calling all cars, attention all cars, broadcast 122. Be on the lookout for a black touring car, license number unknown. The right rear wheel carrying a Stanley skidless tire. Left rear wheel carrying a six-ply Jupiter with a tread slightly worn. This car is worn in connection with the swing of Motor Officer Kramer. That's all. Rolls and clicks.
While gathering information from the police officers who worked on the case you were now to hear, an executive of the Rio Grande Oil Company took the opportunity to ask motorcycle policemen and the police car drivers for their opinion of the Rio Grande cracked gasoline, which has been used exclusively for years by the Los Angeles Police Department. With one exception, these officers praised Rio Grande and admitted that the patented cracking process certainly did give Rio Grande crack more liveliness and prep than other gasoline. They admitted it was the fastest and most powerful gasoline they had ever used. But one hard-boiled old veteran said,
"Sure, you've got to find gasoline for these new high-powered police cars. Those high-compression engines need a gasoline that's all cranked up. So it'll burn instantly. But I don't use your Rio Grande crack in my own car. I've only got an old Ford, and I can't afford your fine Setra Ethyl-treated crack gasoline. I buy the cheapest gasoline I can get. Anything's good enough for my old car."
Well, that was a challenge the Rio Grande executive couldn't ignore. So he persuaded the officer to try a tank full of Rio Grande crack gasoline in the old Ford. And today he received a telephone call from the officer who offered this testimony.
"Officer, I've never been able. My old Ford seems to be a regular police car now. It's a year younger. It's far off and tough. Not so. They are brandy cuts, cutting cuts, and you're blocking your money. I've been sitting here an hour, but I'm getting more miles to the gallon and enjoying police car performance besides."
Now it is our pleasure to present Chief James E. Davis of the Los Angeles Police Department. Chief Davis.
Good evening, friends. Our story tonight goes back quite a few years to the days when science had not yet provided your police officers with the high-speed criminal catching equipment of today. Had we possessed the teletype and radio when motorcycle patrolman Kramer was killed, our murderers would probably have been in custody within an hour of the time he unwisely fired his gun. This murderer committed the arch crime. He killed a police officer. Though it may take years, and though the criminal may escape to the ends of the earth, one thing is certain. He who kills a policeman will eventually be brought before the bars of justice to answer for his crime. For every other police officer in the country is sworn to avenge the murder of a brother officer. They never rest until the policeman's killer has either been placed behind prison bars or, preferably, executed.
It is a few days before Christmas. Motorcycle officers Tom Kramer and E.J. Lanise are stationed at the corner of 23rd and Main Street in Los Angeles, when a big black touring car careens around the corner near a police car. Kramer whistles for the car to stop, but it roars on down 23rd Street. Kramer gets over his motor and races off after it. Not that the fast the race continues until the driver in the black car suddenly slows down, leans out, and pumps three shots into the pursuing motorcycle. As Kramer, a bullet in his chest, wavers crazily, crashing into the curb, the big black touring car roars away into the night. Within a few minutes, a detachment of detectives under the leadership of Sergeant Joe Taylor, the present chief of detectives, arrives at the scene. The officers push their way through the silent crowd of the killed body of Officer Kramer, lying under an arc light beside his wrecked motorcycle. Officer Lanise, shaken with grief at the death of his partner, tells his story to Sergeant Taylor.
"You see, Sergeant, we were parked at the corner of 23rd and Main when a big black car came tearing along. Nearly run into a streetcar. Tom took out after it. And a minute later, I went after some bird in the roadster doing about 50. I didn't know anything had happened until I heard the siren on your car.
Toward midnight, while police are combing the city for a suspicious black touring car, Officer Paul Stevens touches a very frightened young girl of 13 in the detective bureau. In the presence of Chief Butler, Detective Lieutenant George K. Holm, and Sergeant Taylor, he tells her story.
From the market place at dinner time tonight, when a car drove up and passed ahead of me, just as I passed it, a man jumped out and grabbed me. I screamed and he hit me. He said he'd kill me if I made any more noise, and I was scared, so I kept crying. He stuck a handkerchief into my mouth and tied my hands and feet with leather straps, and he tied a cap around my head. And when he got in the car, he started off. A little while later, I heard a whistle like his pace and moving. And then I heard a siren. And then I heard a popping noise like the power blowing out.
You heard a popping noise?
Yes, sir.
And where did this happen?
Oh, I was walking down 8th Street.
And Kramer was shot on 23rd.
Ties in.
Go on with your story, Bruce.
Well, after I heard that noise, we drove faster and faster. And we left the smooth road and there was some bumpy road. And then he stopped. And he lifted me out of the car and laid me down on the ground. We were way out in the country in the middle of a big field.
Now, do you think you could find this field again?
Oh, yes, sir. You see, after he kept me there for a long time, he said he'd made a mistake and he kidnapped the wrong girl. So he said if I told him not to tell anybody about it, he'd let me go. I told him I didn't know how to find my way home, sir. So he picked me up and carried me across the field to a road. And he gave me a dime and told me to walk straight ahead to the car line. I couldn't walk very well with the straps tied in my ankles. So I sat down and took them off and then I ran as fast as I could until I got to the streetcar line. And then I told the conductor I'd been kidnapped and here I am. And now I'd like to go home because my mother will be worried.
Yes, we'll take you home in just a minute.
Well, what streetcar line was it, do you remember?
Oh, it said University Avenue.
Did he hurt you in any way?
Oh, no. He just hit me when I screamed. But after that, he was very kind to me.
Did you get a good look at this man?
No, sir. It was dark and I couldn't see him very well.
Well, would you recognize his voice?
I don't think so. Because he talked in whispers and he made me whisper, too. He acted like he was scared.
I suppose he would. Was he drunk?
I don't know. He smelled kind of funny, though. Oh, I forgot to tell you. When he was putting the straps on my arms, I bit him. I bit his finger awful hard. He said I know he bit it off.
Do you think you left the scar?
Oh, I think I dented it a little anyway.
You didn't notice the license number that it tied, did you?
No, sir. I couldn't have seen it because he had the lights off when we were in the field.
You said you had a basket of groceries with you?
Yes, sir.
What happened to it?
Oh, well, out there in the field, I guess.
What was in the basket?
Oh, there was a package of bacon and liver and 2 loaves of bread and a pound of butter.
Now, can you think of anything else that happened? Anything that you haven't told us?
No, sir. It was raining. I'm awfully tired. May I go home now?
You bet you may, Ruth. You've been a mighty brave girl, and we appreciate the help you've given us. Ruth is escorted home to her parents, who are on the point of notifying the police of their daughter's disappearance when the officers deliver her to them. And next day, the officers take up Ruth's trail from the end of the University Avenue streetcar line, follow her footprints down the road, pick up the trail of a man, which leads them to tire tracks beside a mound of dirt in the middle of the field.
There's a handkerchief.
Well, let me see it.
Yep, that's the one he used to gagger with, all right.
Yeah.
Any identification mark?
Longer mark, number 405.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll have to check that.
Wonder what's under this mound of dirt. Looks like it's just been turned over. Here you are, George. The groceries the kid bought. Barry.
Yeah, and I've got a hunch he buried the gun out there, too. You better call headquarters, Joe, and have them send out a photographer and a man who knows tire marks.
Okay.
Hey, and tell them to send some more boys out to see. I'm sure that this gun is around here somewhere.
While Holm and Taylor wait for the men from headquarters, they begin to dig up the ground around the tire tracks with spades borrowed from a nearby rancher. But after a half hour of fast breaking work, When the photographer and the fireman arrive, they have found nothing. Carefully, the fireman examines the mark.
Well, Stephen, what do you say?
The rear left wheel carried a six-ply Jupiter with the tread slightly worn. The rear right tire is a Stanley Kidney.
Well, that's something to go on at any rate. A black clearing car with a Jupiter six-ply and a Stanley Kidney on the rear wheels. And now, if he could only find that button.
Late that afternoon, the officers do dig up the dirt and cut the gun. And while squads of police comb Los Angeles laundries for the owner of laundry mark number 405, and others are on a keen lookout for a black touring car with the incriminating tires, Chief Butler sends a telegram
to the Cold Zone Company. Can you inform us to whom was sold the Colt 32 caliber revolver, number 164256? John L. Butler, Chief of Police, Los Angeles.
John L. Butler, Chief of Police, Los Angeles. Our 32 caliber revolver, number 164256, sold to Martin Hardware Company, San Francisco.
Chief of Police, San Francisco. Kindly check sale of Colt's 32 caliber revolver, number 164256, consigned to the Martin Hardware Company in your city. John L. Butler, Chief of Police, Los Angeles.
John L. Butler, Chief of Police, Los Angeles. Our records show Colt's revolver, number 164256, pawned here June 20th by one Arthur Anderson, redeemed December 17th. Our officers are attempting to interview Mr. Anderson.
Now, Mr. Anderson, we want to know about a gun you pawned last June 20th and redeemed on the 17th of December.
Well, I don't know anything about pawning a gun.
Where are you on the 20th of December?
Right here in San Francisco.
When did you last leave San Francisco?
I haven't been out of town for 6 months.
You own a gun, Mr. Anderson?
Oh, well, I used to have one.
What kind?
Colt, I think it was.
32?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Where is it now?
Well, I gave it to my brother.
And where's your brother?
Well, he's in Los Angeles the last time I heard from him.
Where in Los Angeles?
Well, you don't think I would have reported my brother, do you?
It's bad business withholding information from the police, Mr. Anderson.
And the boys down in Los Angeles will find him anyway. So you might as well be smart and play on the side of the law.
Oh, all right. Last I heard from Walter, he was living out in Inglewood. 7-4.
Next day, Anderson's brother, Walter, is arrested by Detective Sergeant H.H. Klein and Sidney Hickok and brought in for questioning. At headquarters, he faces an ominous ring of officers firing questions at him.
Why did you kill that motorcycle officer?
I didn't.
Well, why did you kidnap that little girl?
I don't know nothing about it.
This is your gun, isn't it?
Oh.
Where's the best car used for getaway?
An elephant.
Well, it doesn't look that way to us, Anderson. This gun, which we know belongs to your brother in San Francisco, and which he said he lent to you, is the gun which killed Officer Kramer. And we'll prove all that in court, and we'll swing you as sure as you're sitting here.
But I said I'm innocent.
Well, you haven't convinced us yet of that.
Well, you see, it was this way. I lent a gun to a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah?
That sounds familiar.
You don't expect us to believe that, do you?
Well, all right, let him alone, boys. Let him tell his story. Go on, Anderson.
Well,
when I asked my friend to give the gun back to me, he said he'd be ditched it. He wouldn't tell me where.
Who was his friend?
I don't want to mention no names. Anyway, I ain't see you.
Okay, go on.
Well, a few days later, my friend came up to my place and asked me to lend him $200. I told him I didn't have no dough, and that's when... He said he guessed he'd have to tell me about the gas.
Look, oh, boys,
I can't go through with it. I can't turn in a pal.
Well, maybe you'd rather swing for the job yourself.
What's the name of this friend of yours?
His name's Jim Darwin. He said he was planning to kidnap a young kid whose family got dough. But that night he got drunk and grabbed the wrong kid. Before he knew it, though, that speed cop started after him. Well, he was all balled up. He couldn't stand a pinch with his kid all tied in the back seat. So he left the cop a habit. And he saw he bumped the cop off, and he sobered up in a hurry.
Yeah, imagine he did.
So he drove the girl out to the country and turned her loose.
Well, where's this Jim Darwin now?
No. But he ain't around L.A., that's a thing.
Well, who else did this Darwin know in Los Angeles?
He's hanging around with a dame that runs a rooming house over on Grand Avenue. He said he was going to try to get the $200 from her.
What number on Grand Avenue?
Grand South, I think.
What's her name?
I don't know her name. She can't miss her. She's short and heavy. She can't miss her.
Amen. You and Bo better go over there and talk to this woman.
Yes, sir, right away. Come on, Bo.
A few moments later, Detectives Taylor and Bo are interviewing the landlady at the Grand Avenue address.
You're the proprietor here?
Yeah.
No, man named Jim Garland.
He's rooms here.
Pretty good friend of yours, isn't he?
I don't know how that's any of your business.
It is our business. You see, we're police officers.
What of it?
Isn't it true that you and Jim Garland are... close friends?
I don't have to answer your question.
No, you don't. I think you better.
They're looking for Jim Darwin on a murder charge.
What?
Yeah, he murdered a police officer while he was kidnapping a young girl.
Where is he?
I don't know.
He lives here, doesn't he?
Yeah, but he ain't here now. So that's what he wanted the $200 for.
What did you say?
He borrowed $200 from me. Said his mother was dying in Chicago and he had to get to her.
When was this?
Just before Christmas.
And you lent him the money?
Yeah.
When you were close to him?
Yeah. I loved him, I guess.
What did he tell you about the murder?
Nothing. I don't know nothing about it.
Sure of that?
Positive.
Has his room been rented?
No, I've been keeping it for him. I thought he'd be back soon. Looks like he won't now, though.
I wouldn't think so.
What's in his room?
Right here.
Oh, next door to yours, eh? Quite convenient. Got a key to it?
Yeah.
Open it up.
And you've got to have a search warrant.
Listen, if you're smart, you won't give us any trouble. You know we can get a search warrant in 15 minutes, so why be tough? Just open up that room.
All right.
There's a picture of him on the bureau?
Yeah.
These are his handkerchiefs in this drawer?
I guess so.
Look here, boy.
What?
These handkerchiefs all have the laundry mark number 405. Same as the handkerchief he used to gag that kid with.
Yes, that's clear as Mr. Anderson.
There's no question about it now. Jim Darwin is the man we want.
Well, you'll never get him, I can tell you. He's too smart for you coppers.
Nevertheless, the officers stake out Darwin's room for several days in the hope that he may attempt to return to see his anomaly. The photograph of Darwin is reproduced on circulars and sent to peace officers all over the United States. And on January 9th, the taciturn landlady on Grand Avenue, after repeated questioning, admits that Darwin had another address in Inglewood. Taylor and Bo immediately drive out to the house, only to find...
Doesn't look as though anyone is living here, Bo.
Nope. No curtains on the window, no furniture in the room.
Let's have a look around back.
All right. Garage door is locked.
Grab that rock there. We'll open it quicker.
Okay. Okay, look. We'll start with some attention. Here comes the next door neighbor.
Anyone looking for someone?
Yeah. Who lived in this house last?
Mr. Lawrence, but he moved.
How long ago?
Oh, sometime before Christmas.
Say his name was Lawrence, eh?
That's what he called himself.
What's in this garage?
I don't know.
Take a crack at that padlock with the rod, though.
Hey, now look here. Now, you can't go break him into there.
No, well, we're doing it.
Well, I'll call the police. Now, that's what I'll do.
Oh, save it. We're the police.
The police? Well, what seems to be the matter?
A little murder case.
Murder? Well, boy, yeah,
yeah,
Joe.
Yeah, yeah.
Pull it off.
All right.
A black touring car.
Yeah. You say, look, on the rear wheel. The Sandals Sitters on the right and the Six Flags Jupiter on the left.
This is a getaway car, no mistake.
You say Mr. Lawrence left here before Christmas?
Yeah.
Where'd he go?
Well, he said he had to go east. His mother was sick.
Did you see him drive in here on the 17th of December?
Well, no, I don't remember dates.
You say he left here just before Christmas.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, was he driving the car the last 2 days before he left?
Come to think of it, he wasn't. I remember remarking to the missus that was strange. Mr. Lawrence was using the streetcar. I don't think he used his automobile after that morning he cleaned off the driveway.
What's that?
Well, one morning early, I saw him driving into the garage. And he got out and scraped the muddy tracks from the driveway and then washed the driveway with a hose. Funny thing, too. It looked like rain that day.
Covering up, though.
Yeah.
Could that have been the morning of the 17th of December?
Oh, well, it could have been, but of course I can't be sure. I never was much of a hand for remembering dates.
From the black murder car, police obtained fingerprints of the wanted man, and these with his picture are broadcast across the country. But months go by, and the unwavering vigilance of the Los Angeles officers goes unrewarded. Then, nearly a year later, a citizen and taxpayer calls on Lieutenant Holm at the detective bureau.
Lieutenant Holm? My name is Randolph. John Randolph.
Yes, Mr. Randolph.
You investigated that murder of a police officer last Christmas, didn't you?
Yes, I worked on that case.
Well, I just returned from a business trip to Mexico, and something happened down there that I thought you'd be interested in.
Yes?
I was visiting a friend of mine, Don Romero, who has a big cattle ranch down in Sonora, near Hermosillo.
Yeah, go on.
Well, while I was there, one of the cowboys struck up an acquaintance with me. Noticed the California plate on my car and started asking a lot of questions about Los Angeles. and particularly about the murder of that policeman. Now, it struck me funny that he was so interested in that case, and I felt it my duty to tell you about it as soon as I got back.
What is the name of this fellow?
Don Romero said his name was Jim Berwin.
Jim Berwin?
Berwin?
Darwin.
Joe
Taylor?
Yes, George. Take in that job and check it, will you? By the way.
Did this fellow give you any reason for being so interested in the Kramer killing?
Well, he said he knew a man who was a friend of the officer's.
We are, George. All right, fine, thanks. Now, Mr. Randolph, did your cowboy look anything like this?
Yes, that's a very good picture of it.
Fine. You'll pack your bags. You're leaving for Hermosillo, Mexico, to arrest a cowboy named Jim Berwin for the murder of Tom Kramer.
Six hours later, Taylor and Bell leave the railway at Hermosillo and, hiring a rickety jitney, begin the long, bumpy trip across the rolling green range of northern Sonora. Hours later, they approach the hacienda of Don Romero.
Patron! Mira! Dos gringos vienen!
Yes. Yes, yes. Yes, senor. You're welcome to the hacienda of Don Romero.
Oh, thanks.
Are you Don Romero?
At your service, senor.
I'm Detective Sergeant Taylor of the Los Angeles Police Department. This is Detective Sergeant Bowles.
I am honored, senor. You will be so kind as to accept the humble comforts of my hacienda.
Thanks, Don Romero, but we will have to dispense it for an hour. It isn't getting fun.
Oh, you Mexicanos. Always in a hurry. Bueno, what is the, as you say, point?
We're looking for a cowboy that works for you. Named Jim Berwin.
Jim Berwin?
Yes, where is he?
He's gone.
Gone?
Si, senor. He talked one day with his countryman of yours. Mi amigo, Senor Randolph. Next day, Senor Randolph leaves for Los Angeles. The day after that, Hotel Berwin, he leaves too. He's hard to understand, you Americano.
Well, where did he go?
He did not stop to say, senor. You see, when he left, some things of value left with him.
Several more months go by with no word of the murderer. And then, nearly 3,000 miles away, in the little town of Greensburg, Pennsylvania, two men meet in a saloon.
I've been looking for you, Frank.
Yeah, what's that?
Listen. I warned you to keep away from Margie.
Yeah?
She's my dame, see?
Well, I should think she'd have something to say about that.
I'm telling you, but I ain't time to take mine.
That's not what you told me.
You lied.
Oh, go on. See this. Why can't you be out there a little bit?
Hey, bartender, give me a drink.
Fry never regains consciousness, and police, provided by witnesses of a description of the killer who is known in Greensburg as Edward Mellay, throw a dragnet around Allegheny County. Then, 24 hours later, a confused gentleman walks into the Northside Police Station in Pittsburgh.
Yes, sir, what is it? Well, Johnson here, I don't know whether I'd be after seeing things or what, but I was just walking home from work, and as I was passing under the Fort Wayne Railroad Bridge on Martin Street, I seen a man's foot sticking out. Well, I yelled, and the foot pulled right out of sight.
What?
As sure as I'm gone, that's what I seen. He must be between the tracks with his hands peeled over the street. Maybe he's stuck or something.
We'll investigate it right away.
The man hiding in the bridge refuses to give himself up, and quick-witted Officer McNulty plans a harmless way of ejecting him.
And it won't come out.
I see.
Help me to hold some hide over there, boy.
I think about 9 pounds threshold riding, Mom.
Go on, Mom. Oh, I'm back to you, sir, when you come out. Oh, I didn't see you about that. All right, get him out of there and throw him between the steel and the press.
Who is this guy? He's probably up for no good if he refuses to give himself up.
He'll give himself up after he gets the taste of that hose.
Turn around.
Come out now.
I'll tell you, I'm coming.
It's me.
that's the curse on him up there, Eddie.
Don't worry, I will as soon as I get the water out of the ears.
You didn't get wet too, did you?
No, I didn't get wet. I got soaked.
The recalcitrant prisoner is taken in, booked on a technical charge, and fingerprinted. Next morning, he's interviewed by Captain of Detectives Clyde Edeburn of the Pittsburgh Police Department.
What's your name?
James Blanchfield.
Alias Edward Melly.
I don't know what you mean.
Alias Jim Berwin. Alias Jim Darwin.
I don't know what you're talking about.
As Edward Melly, you shot and killed Edward Cry in Greensburg last week. As Jim Berwin, you worked on a ranch in Mexico last year. As Jim Darwin, you kidnapped a little girl in Los Angeles 2 years ago. Shot and killed a motorcycle officer, making your getaway. And if we don't send you up for murder from Allegheny County, you'll go up for murder from Los Angeles. How about it? Have I made any mistakes so far?
Nope, Captain. I guess not. I guess you're about 100% right.
Although Los Angeles authorities did their best to extradite Darwin and bring him to trial for the murder of Officer Kramer, the Allegheny County officials insist on prosecuting him for the Greensburg murder. He was found guilty and sentenced to the Western Penitentiary in Pennsylvania for not less than 19 nor more than 20 years on a verdict of second-degree murder. When he has served his time, we still have a hold against him and hope that we may bring him to Los Angeles and try him for the murder of our brother officer.
Thank you, Chief Davis. If there is a single boy or girl listening tonight who has not yet seen the free G-Man and Junior Police outfit, go to your neighborhood Rio Grande cracked gasoline dealer and learn how you can get a lot of valuable gifts absolutely free. If there's anyone listening who has not yet read the Calling All Cars news, then by all means get a free copy from your Rio Grande dealer. And if there is any motorist listening who has not yet tried Sinclair Motor Oil, then we warn you, you're missing the greatest value your Rio Grande dealer offers. Lubrication experts the world over know that Sinclair's unique process of extracting useless wax and petroleum jelly leaves an absolutely pure oil. In cold weather, when most oils congeal like hard, stiff butter, Sinclair motor oils lubricate perfectly. At high speed, the wax and jelly and other oils thin out dangerously, until fast-moving parts get no lubrication at all. Expert oil buyers, every one of the 150 railroads and the leading airlines, specify Sinclair motor oils because they are de-waxed and de-jellied. These orders from the country's largest oil users, as well as the demand from millions of smart motorists, have made Sinclair the largest refiner of lubricants in America. Their tremendous volume enables them to give you Sinclair motor oils in sealed cans at bargain prices for such high quality. Only 25 cents a quart for Opaline and 30 cents for pure Pennsylvania. You can get Sinclair motor oils wherever Rio Grande cracked gasoline is sold.
Welcome, Miss Lee, calling all cars, attention all cars. The cancellation broadcast 122. The section of case now in custody. That's all.
Your narrator, Frederick Lindsley, bidding you good night for the Rio Grande Oil Company. Listen to Calling All Cars, now also broadcast over the Western Network, KMX Hollywood, KSFO San Francisco, every Thursday evening, 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time and 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.